You're listening to By the Well, a podcast brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Fran Barber. And this week is the 17th week after Pentecost. And we'll be focusing on Matthew 21, verses 23 to 32, and the Exodus reading, chapter 17, verses 1 to 7.
Fran, let's start with the gospel today, with Matthew.
Yeah.
Where are we? Because we've sort of jumped ahead a bit.
Yeah, so I think it is important if you're going to preach on this passage to get the narrative context. So what we know in Matthew is that Jesus has entered Jerusalem on the donkey just before this passage, and he has also cleansed the temple. And so the questions of authority that are so dominant in Matthew anyway really are coming to the fore as Jesus challenges authorities of various kinds.
Yeah. And in some ways our reading has two parts. We have a dialogue between Jesus and the Jewish authorities and then a parable.
Mm.
And there's a lot in this passage.
Yeah.
It's worth saying this parable only occurs in Matthew's gospel.
Yes. Yeah, I meant to say that, yes. So interesting. So you only get one chance every 3 years to...
So you might want to do this passage for that reason.
Yeah.
And it's an unusual parable in some ways. But let's go to the beginning, because I actually find it quite astonishing when you think of that, this social context, that Jesus, who is basically just, you know, from a human point of view, a regular bloke from rural Galilee, is in the temple, the pinnacle of Jewish life. Mm. It's like one of us wandering on into the Vatican and delivering a sermon.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. And I think it is lost on us, you know, that what's going on here is so stark or surprising.
Yeah.
And shocking.
And the language is his teaching. He's teaching, you know, as he has done in other scenes, as one having authority. But his clothing and persona and probably accent would all give away where he's from, and none of the authorities there would know him necessarily unless they've heard rumour of him, given his maybe dramatic entrance into the city. So I say that because I think, you know, if we wandered into the Vatican and just started delivering an impromptu sermon, we would expect to be bailed up by a priest or cardinal and be like, what are you doing?
Yeah, yeah, and maybe thought to be a bit crazy or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's not an unreasonable initial challenge, I want to say.
No, and then for Jesus to ask them, I mean, I suppose that the chief priests are used to being asked questions.
It's a very Jewish way of dialoguing.
Yeah,
of course. A sort of question back and forth.
Yeah.
For him to
say, if you tell me the answer, then I'll do this. I don't know, I feel that's very much challenging their authority.
It is, and it's a little cagey in a way. I don't know if that's quite the right word, but if we were in a conversation with someone and they were like, well, I'll only tell you if you tell me this, it feels like a manipulative way of communicating.
Mm.
Let's perhaps map this out a little bit. And I've got N.T. Wright's translation here, and he actually quite delightfully, it's a bit of a colloquial translation in some ways. Mm. And, you know, so he has the initial question in verse 23 from the chief priests and elders is, by what right are you doing these things? Who gave you this right?
Right.
And then Jesus replying, I'm going to ask you one question too, and if you give me the right answer, I'll tell you by what right I'm doing these things. Now, the language in the Greek is authority, but it sort of gets to the heart of what they're doing. And the John the Baptist test case, I think, is interesting because we get a number of things revealed here. One is that the crowd liked John the Baptist.
Mm.
And therefore, these leaders are afraid of the crowd.
So if they give the wrong answer or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we'll see the crowd, as we get into the passion narrative, do play a role. The crowd has power.
Mm.
So we're seeing the power of the masses. We see that the temple leaders are not prepared to say John was a prophet, But we also see Jesus aligning himself really strongly with John, the Baptist.
One interpretation I came across in this passage suggested that the chief priest's answer to the question was given in humility, but I would have to disagree vehemently with that because, you know, they rejected John quite outright when he was around. So, you know, we know what they think. And for me, the crux of this passage is that dynamic of consistency within and without. You know, do you say what you really believe? And that human reality at the human level that so often really we, out of fear, we might not say what we really think publicly for fear of what the reaction will be, whether that's just general conflict because others don't agree or whether it's because we will, you know, we'll be rejected ourselves.
Or political fallout in their case in some ways.
In their case, So for me, I think that's where I'd go with this passage, is this dynamic here where they're just not being honest. That public declaration is not consistent with what's going on inside them. They're giving that to a man, Jesus, who is internally and externally consistent.
Yep.
All through his obedience and his life. Sorry.
And who is prepared to speak truth boldly, even when that comes at great cost.
Yeah, the cross.
Ultimately. I really like that because that to me then makes sense of where the parable goes and Matthew's arrangement of this, in that it's kind of building. So if the first part is about say what you actually believe, we're now going to get a story that's actually do what you say or that, you know, it's not enough to just say something if you don't actually do it. Again, if your behavior doesn't match your words and your belief, you also haven't embodied faith. But maybe should we look at the parable quickly? It's a father and two sons, and in the sort of pre-Reformation tradition, the major way of interpreting these two sons has been that the first one, who said, I don't want to work, but ultimately does, represents the Gentiles, who weren't initially part of God's plan but stepped up. Mm-hmm. And that the second son, who says, I'll do the right thing, but then doesn't, is the Jews.
Mm-hmm. And that's very tidy.
It's very tidy. It's a bit too tidy. It's also, quite frankly, supersessionist.
Yeah.
It paints all Jews as this and all Gentiles as that. And I want to suggest it's far more complicated because both sons are disobedient to a certain extent and both sons are obedient to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Neither says, yes, I'll do it, and does it. Neither perfects faith in a sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a sage advice about, because you can easily fall into that here, because the chief priests are getting challenged, and I think often as preachers we might just throw that line in, chief priests, and you know what we're actually doing is typecasting our whole faith out of using just that phrase.
Yes, and partly because I think when Jesus is talking at the end in verse 31 about the tax collectors and prostitutes going into the kingdom ahead of you, and he's clearly talking to the leadership at this point. We shouldn't assume that tax collectors and prostitutes are not Jews.
No.
Like, we know there were Jewish tax collectors.
That's an interesting
Matthew
point.
Or Levi is arguably a Jewish tax collector. So we shouldn't assume they're not Jews, but it's more about who gets priority in God's kingdom.
Yeah.
And it's those whose action in following Jesus maps onto their words or their confession, I guess.
And it is, you know, it's also at the human or lyric level, it's what we do, you know.
Yeah.
We say one thing, we'll get around to it maybe, you know.
Yes.
You know, think twice, oh, yeah, I'll do it.
We say what we think people want to hear.
Yes.
But, So there's a theme with what you were saying before, Fran, for me that I think says, you know, it's say what you believe and do what you say, like the living out the fullness of faith, which no one in this story quite reaches, no human in the story reaches, but, you know, that a truly kind of perfect's the wrong word, but a good exemplar of faith would be someone who believes and says and does, and there's integrity in those actions. Are there other themes here to preach before we move on?
Well, I did come across a sermon that Craig Thompson wrote where he took this disjunction between the public declaration and what you actually believe and went into quite a profound narrative about the nature of God, that the God in whose image we are made and who leads us is a God who is through and through inside the same. God is as God. God is inside God's self as God acts outside. So he talked basically about the Trinity, but which I think for some people might be going, I don't know, abstract, but it absolutely isn't when you go down that line. And that the gospel says, you know, in the gospel itself is the fact that we will fail. We will fail to be consistent. Yeah. We'll fail at being as good as Jesus, in the which is depicted beautifully, incidentally, people, in the Philippians reading today, which we're not going into here, but Robin and Sean Winter did a podcast on Philippians, number 146, which is out now. So if you're
145, I'll beg your pardon, just going to correct you. 145.
You know, yeah, that's an important
where question. We discuss that Christological hymn of Philippians 2.
Yeah.
Which is, again, a beautiful passage to preach on.
Yeah, so the gospel, within the gospel itself is the truth that we'll fail to be embodied as, you know, as Jesus is, but God remains inside us and for us, and that that is the liberating grace.
I think I see a bit of grace too in this first son who sort of says no but then comes back around, you know, there's a, you know, and this is, again, extrapolating this out to the gospel writ large, but there is a chance for all of us to change our minds. I mean, that's what repentance is, and that's implied in the language of Jesus talking about tax collectors and prostitutes, because in the ministry that's preceded this for 20 chapters, these are the people Jesus has called, and they're the ones who've repented
and
followed.
There's also no sort of punishment, but there's no sort of punishment built into this little parable for the one who didn't obey either. It's just that's what happens, you know. This is what happens in response to faith all the time.
Yes. Yeah. And we see that in the world at large. I mean, I think it's why our sense of betrayal is so strong when a church leader or a Christian leader you know, is either exposed for whether it's an affair or for abuse or something like that, because we expect words and actions, what we confess and do, to match. And so it's a double kind of betrayal of those ideals when someone so clearly do not. You know, they've been espousing the gospel with their mouth and then doing something deeply wrong in other places. Yeah.
So I think that's a really solid theme you could go into for this passage this time.
It strikes me just pastorally. I mean, the other theme, if you want to play with the authority question and the Jesus leadership dynamic, I mean, there is, I don't know if this is sermon fodder or maybe more for reflection for those who hold power and influence in church spaces, but, you know, there is something in this story that, again, is very human about the way we react to new teaching or new ideas, particularly when they come from people and places that we don't think have authority. We tend to be suspicious. We tend to interrogate them more thoroughly. And what would it mean, you know, to have been able to be someone in this passage who could hear Jesus teaching and not be skeptical and not challenge it? And what might that look like in our context today?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question too. When I think about what people have reported around, you know, this whole new way of being church and going online, and that it's included, it's meant people who perhaps weren't in particular leadership in a community have certain skills that are needed now, and they are stepping up. And, you know, they've got all these gifts to offer that maybe were never even known about before or were not valued before. So I think, there's a little conversation there too.
Great. Let's talk about Exodus.
Yes.
17, 1 to 7. Another grumbling story.
Yes, it is.
Another complaining.
I think this passage is fantastic for these strange times we're living through now. I enrolled in a course with a couple of colleagues through Luther Seminary on how to lead when you don't know where you're going, which is now finished, but with Susan Beaumont. But this, and it's all about leading through what's called liminal time or massive change, where you, something's finished, but you've got no idea, and something's going to come that'll be new. And in this case, the Israelites know it's a promised land, you know. But
they don't know what it looks like.
They don't know what it looks like, no. But that what we have in this passage here is the very human response to that unknowing, the anxiety, the blame, the anger, the resentment. So maybe we should perhaps, I'm interested first, if I can, to ask about the wilderness of sin. I must confess that in my looking at this passage in the past, I hadn't quite, I just thought it was wilderness. Can you talk through, you know, why it's wilderness of sin?
So we shouldn't read wilderness of sin as some spiritual name. It happens to look like the word sin in English, but it's just a Hebrew word. Literally alliterated here, sin in Hebrew, which is somewhere in Egypt. So it's it's a place and it doesn't have any spiritual significance.
That is important to clarify with your community people.
Yes. So it's not like these are bad people because they're in a wilderness of sin. It's not some like spiritual. Good question.
Right.
Yep. But they've moved.
They've moved. I think there's so much just in this first verse around what's going on here. You know, they're on the move. The Lord's commanded, so we know the Lord knows where they're going, even though they don't trust God at the moment and they're all of a, fluster. God knows where they're going. The wilderness might seem God-forsaken, but actually it's not.
No, because God's leading them.
Yeah, and they camped at Rephidim.
Yep.
And an important commentary I read said this is not just an interesting itinerary, but naming the places is, like sin, the place sin, is really emphasising these people are on the move. They're between promise and fulfilment. I know Frethheim really emphasises that aspect of where they're going. You know, that these are people between promise and fulfilment. And the wilderness is a real thing, but it's also a state of mind.
Yes. And the other thing, there's a misunderstanding, and this is why the first verse is also important, because as you've said, God is leading them, but they keep grumbling to Moses. Their grumbles to Moses are, you've done this to us, you've brought us here, you've led us to a place of death. There's a sense that they still haven't quite gotten that God is doing this.
Or whether, is it possible that the narrator is depicting their quarrelsome with God by equating it with, so if they're quarrelling with Moses, what they're doing is quarrelling with God.
Well, I think Moses turns that around because he turns it around and says, why do you test the Lord? So we have twice repeated a grumbling when they say we don't have water in various ways or why have you brought us to die? So that's repeated, and then twice Moses responds, and he does frame it as, why are you testing the Lord? And then he goes to God and is basically afraid he's going to be killed by the people.
So is grumbling a better word than quarrelled? Because I've got quarrelled, things that I read and I'm familiar with is quarrelled.
Yeah, and what does the NRSV have? Complained. Grumbling is my word I'm using. The word in Robert Alter, who's an Old Testament scholar who's done a whole new translation of the Hebrew Bible, he uses murmuring. So I think I use grumbling because there's a sense of, like, you know, the muttering, that gossip muttering of blah, 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 we don't have
them.
It has that sense to it, the word. So he actually has that they murmured against.
Yeah, maybe they, yes. Yeah, okay. So it's interesting. I've got quarrel, which I thought was the NRSV one.
I think they have complained. You know, in Australian parlance, it might be their whining or griping kind of.
Whereas to me, the word quarrel's got a lot more confrontation in it, actually.
Yeah, Yeah, I don't find that a particularly helpful translation, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I get that. Yep.
But I'm not an expert in Hebrew, so, you know.
No, well, if you know more than I do.
So we should point out we've got symbolic action here that points to continuity. So the Lord's response is take your staff. This is the same staff that touched the Nile. There's explicit reference to that previous use of staff. And, of course, in that earlier story, it was used as a destructive force to touch the Nile and turn it into blood, to turn it into undrinkable water.
Mm.
Now the same staff and the same divine action is going to turn a rock into drinkable water.
And it's also happening at the place that Moses was called first. Isn't that right?
Yes, I think so.
I think it is in Exodus 3.
In a similar area, yep.
So there's, you know, that's not accidental either, I'm sure.
No. So there's a very similar story. This is one of the fun things I learned preparing this week. There's a very similar story in Numbers 20. Also has Moses striking a rock, grumbling, etc. And apparently Pete Enns talks about this on his podcast, The Bible for Normal People, and he is a Hebrew Bible scholar. And he says there was an ancient Jewish interpretation that there was this rock in the wilderness that actually followed the people of God around, because we have these multiple stories of Moses striking a rock but in different locations. So he talks about this rock that kind of rolled around the wilderness. We might think of this almost as a magic rock, but this divine providence. But it explains, this is entirely a little side note but important, in 1 Corinthians 10:4, where Paul writes all about the people in the wilderness with Moses on the way to the promised land, he says the rock that followed them was Christ. And scholars have always been puzzled, why would you talk about a rock that followed people? And we now think it's because there was this ancient Jewish interpretation that this is a rock that literally followed the people.
That's fantastic. I love those little links.
I know. So probably not really a whole sermon in there, but
I mean, you could do, if your online sermon's only 6 minutes these days, you could do that.
Yeah, that could be your sermon. So anyway, I thought that was interesting, and it gives us again a little insight into how some of those things that are so weird to us in the New Testament make sense when we understand a fuller Jewish tradition that Paul would be participating in. But,
So with this reading too, obviously you could go the tack of Moses and the person of Moses and the nature of Moses' leadership.
Yeah.
I'm just interested in when he goes to the God and says, what shall I do with his people? So just before this, they're almost ready to stone me. And we all know, you know, if you've been leading a group of people and they're not happy with what's going on, that's very real. And he's told to go on ahead of the people. And I understand from the Hebrew there, go cross over, go before the face of. So actually the verb I understand is about, it's not, he's saying to Moses, you've got to just front up to this.
Yes, yes. It's kind of almost pass before them, like.
Yeah, pass before them.
You've got to
them
go through them. You can't avoid the people.
See their faces and actually see what it is, you know.
Yeah.
And also but take some of the elders of Israel with you. There's another point, and I'm not sure if it's the chapter before this, but Moses is really bemoaning how much weight is upon him and all these disputes he's having to solve. And, you know, God says you need to delegate.
you need to have support. You've got to take
these
people.
Support. Yeah. And so here, take some of the elders of Israel with you. And these elders will carry with them the story of what's happened to you all. They'll carry all the hurt and the, you know, the joy and the hopes. And they'll witness to that in the, you know, they're coming before you, will witness to what the fact that I've been faithful.
Yes.
And I continue to be your faithful and continue to be your God.
And that's a great point.
Ministry and courageousness and stuff, I think.
And so often we encounter Moses in these stories as a bit of an isolated leader. Although we should say it's often Moses and Aaron, so he's actually not as isolated, but we tend to isolate Moses. So to actually point out that little detail is really important. I mean, theologically, this is obviously, you know, about God's provision that, you know, and abundance. It feeds the people and the flocks, I think. are mentioned here.
Yeah, which carries on the themes we spoke about last week.
Yes.
And you've already named, so this is perhaps, is it the second of three miraculous things around water or food and water?
Yes, yeah.
The water was made drinkable. Yep. And, you know, yeah.
Yeah. But we've only got another minute or so left. But
yes.
It seems to me the last line could be your sermon title.
Oh, totally. Yes, I think, is the Lord among us or not? In fact, that's probably the title for every sermon you've ever written, people, in some way or other.
Yeah.
I suppose before I go there, I want to say something about the centrality of water for life.
Yeah.
Here, and there's really quite Australian themes about that. I think it's one of the Working Preacher scholars quotes a medical journal or somewhere that indicates in desert contexts how long a human could survive without water, you know, carrying a whole lot of stuff, and the sort of level of urgency that's going on here. And is God going to save us? Is, you know, and
yes,
I think there's
life or death.
Yeah, and there's, especially in the Australian context, and indeed if we have North American listeners with all the terrible bushfires at the moment.
Yeah.
There are themes there around the desperation.
Yep.
That you
yep.
can evoke if yep. you look reading to the text.
Yep. No, I think that's right. But, you know, as a reflective question, depending how you're doing worship at the moment, this is the Lord in our midst or not? And I guess a follow-up question to that is, how do you know?
How do you know?
Where do you see God?
Where do you see God in your midst?
Yeah. We might
and open. Yeah, and open that question to your community to answer.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening, everyone.
Until next time.